Thanks a lot for coming, and thank you for inviting me here today. I'll be reading from my screen, so don't worry if I look down. I'm just, you know, going to do that. I'll start by saying that a kind of summary of the talk is on the blog. So part of it, pieces of it, are here. So over the last 80 years or so, the history of the transatlantic slave trade and slavery has been vastly studied. Historians have mainly focused on migration, abolition, and in the last 15 years on memorialization. They have tended to make a clear distinction between the history of the slave trade, exchanges, commodities and partnerships on the one hand, and life in the Americas on the other. They also have looked at the social and cultural ramifications of the plantocracy. They have looked at the plantation as a rigorous hierarchical institution that coerced enslaved Africans into working and living in owners' lands in order to continue to produce goods destined for European markets. Other studies have looked at the way European tastes for exotic goods created and transformed social and cultural practices through the establishment of coffee houses, men and women's clubs where these were consumed. Scholars have also looked at the interdependence between consumerism in the 18th and 19th centuries and the development of the European middle class. What all these studies highlight is the close link between the transatlantic slave trade, slavery, and the transformation of European economies, Britain's among them. Very rarely did all these studies make the jump between those histories and memory, legacies and memorialization of slavery. In fact, historians have tended to avoid looking into the cultural, social, and social legacies of that past except to celebrate Britain and other European nations' role in abolition. The refusal to look at the negative legacies of slavery amounted, in my opinion, to a form of collective unconsciousness, to use a term coined by French psychoanalyst and psychiatrist Jacques Lacan. In this case, it means a form of amnesia that was characterized by the way many slaving ports looked at the history of the transatlantic slavery. Quite often, that partial amnesia, paradoxically, looked like a conscious decision to avoid addressing the participation of London, Bristol, Nantes, Bordeaux, La Rochelle, Le Havre, Lisbon, etc. in the slave trade. That particular paradox of collective unconsciousness coupled with a conscious decision could have been a compulsion. Lacan explained that trauma often leads to a pattern of repetition. The repetition of actions is a painful and compulsive process. I might be underqualified to inquire into the European psyche and its links with compulsion and trauma in general, but I'm however qualified, I believe, to see patterns of historical amnesia. After European abolition in 1867, no academic books directly dealing with the history of slavery was written until the 1920s. Give or take a few exceptions, those books were about the economic impact of that trade rather than about the cultural, social, historical consequences of the transatlantic slavery. The end of the First World War had signaled a new world order, and Europe was not floating on the successes of the Industrial Revolution anymore. Imperial powers had been challenged and at war. The threat came from within. It came from Germany. In his seminal volumes, In Search of the Lost Time, novelist Marcel Proust explained how every time he ate a madeleine, a small cake, he remembered his grandmother and memories would come back to him. Memory needs a context and specific interactions. Perhaps war with Germany and its allies was Europe's madeleine to remember colonial fights and the history of the transatlantic slave trade and slavery in particular. What was never forgotten in that history was the history of abolition. Sir Reginald Copeland's biography of William Wilberforce in 1923 became a site of memory for a contested history related to slavery and abolition. I'm using the term site of memory here as defined by historian Pierre Nora. For Nora, books, just like monuments, can be sites of memory. For Copeland, abolition was the result of long moral and humanitarian battles. These views were not unanimously shared. Several historians have argued that Britain's Industrial Revolution was, if not initiated, at least supported by the transatlantic slave trade and slave economy. C.L.R. James put forward the idea in The Black Jacobins, 1938, that France's 18th century industrialization rested upon the shoulders of slave labor, and that Saint-Domingue, nowadays Haiti, was the jewel of the crown that made modern France. 6 years later, in Britain, another author echoed these views. In 1944, Capitalism and Slavery, Eric Williams contended that through goods produced by slaves such as sugar, tobacco, cotton, etc., and with the development of shipbuilding industry, the insurance, the banking sector, and other heavy industries, the transatlantic slave trade, or slavery, helped finance England's industrial revolution in the 18th and 19th centuries. The abolition of the slave trade, he argued, was not the result of moral, religious, and humanitarian considerations as such. Investment and subsequent investment from the slave trade had already brought important dividends that allowed the nation to turn to other industries. In other words, Britain did not need the slave trade anymore. Williams' theory ignited a controversy that is still ongoing. As crucial as these debates were and still are, a very clear distinction was made between the history of slavery, the memory and memorialization of that era. My own research looks at both the history and memory of slavery, as well as the links between the colonial past and its legacies in contemporary societies in Africa, Europe, the Caribbean, and North America. So I will attempt to bring all these arguments together to show that we better understand the history of slavery, migratory flows from Africa to Europe and the Americas, when we view history and memory as two sides of the same coin. I'm also suggesting that there were intellectual wars by proxy over racial superiority. In 1977, Seymour Drescher challenged Williams' narrative in his Econocide, British Slavery in the Era of Abolition. Drescher asserted that moral outrage in Britain led to popular protests and mobilization against the slave trade. The thriving industry of the slave trade could have continued, he claimed, but Britain decided to stop that trade, leading to London Econocide, meaning an economic self-harming decision. North American and British historians shared similar views until Joseph Nicori's Africans and the Industrial Revolution in England was published in 2002, in which he claimed England's Industrial Revolution from 1650 to 1850 resulted in several incidents. He looked at the English economy over a long period of time, analyzing the various factors that may have contributed to the first Industrial Revolution. He then focused on the Atlantic economy, including North America, its growth, its links with other sectors, before linking those points with the manufacturing sectors in England, including the north of the country, and in particular places that saw the development of the textile industry, Manchester, for example. There are two major points to note from these various studies. First, although an uncomfortable discussion for many